Well, thank you, Heather. Now, I find it's very unusual to find anyone who doesn't like stories at all of any sort. Usually we might have a preferred form. Perhaps TV soaps are our favourites, or comics, films, books, Bible stories, folk tales, audio books. People like to listen to audio books, plays, rhymes, dramas on the radio, fables, myths, the archers, on and on and on. So just very quickly, a couple of minutes on your tables if you'd like to, sharing some of your favourite stories. Now, could I suggest you just name them? You don't have to tell them, otherwise we'll be here the rest of the morning. Okay, so if we look at the next slide, it should tell us what we're going to do. There we go. So just a minute or two, sharing some of your favourite stories, just what they are. You may need a word or two of explanation if they're not very well known. Away you go. Okay, if you just like to wind that up a bit. Because we're going to do something further with the things you've mentioned. Okay. You'll notice I didn't say your favourite story, because I think that's almost impossible, isn't it, to pick one. So having mentioned some favourites, and thinking back to the story I told just now about truth and story, just continue your conversation briefly and thinking about in what ways, if you think at all, there's truth in the story or stories you mentioned. How are those stories true? Okay? Is that understood? Do you need a bit more explanation, or are you okay with that? Okay, fine. Okay. Have we found truth in any of those stories, I wonder? Would anybody like to, no compulsion on this, but anyone like to tell us any of the favourite stories? Any of the favourite stories? Yes, Liz? Yeah. If you had Liz said anything by Jane Austen, and the truth in there is so clear from the observation of the way people behave to each other and the fashions of behaviour and manners of the time and so on. So thanks for that. Any other favourites that came out? May not be yours, maybe somebody else's, Trevor?
There's a favourite film of mine called The Fifth Element. It's got Bruce Willis in it. I don't know if you've seen it, but we have the DVD. We watch it every year. It's a story of redemption, of saving the world, of saving the planet.
Wow.
And it's based on love that is the source of that saving grace.
Fantastic. Thank you. Perhaps one more? If anybody wants to, don't feel you have to. But that, yeah.
I enjoyed the book, Good Night, Mr. Tom.
Oh, yes. Yes. That's if you don't know that, it's a lovely story written originally for children, but I don't think you could call it a children's book, about an evacuee in the war from the centre of a big city who was sent out to the countryside to live in the end with, he was the last evacuee to be picked from the village hall, and there was this one grumpy old chap, and he ended up having to take Tom. Sorry, he was Tom. He ended up having to take the boy. I won't tell you any more, but if you can, read it or listen to it, or it has been on TV as well. So, what do we mean by a true story, then? Do we only mean recounting something which is non-fictional completely, that happened to real people and real events, and other people saw them, and so on? Is that what we mean, and nothing else, by a true story? I think that's what children mean. Often you'll tell them a story and they will say, is that true? By which they mean, did it actually happen to those people in exactly the way it's been explained? And I think we've seen that that doesn't necessarily have to be the case. When my wife Pam and I, several years ago now, went to see the first of the Lord of the Rings trilogy films. I'd read the book years before, loved it. Pam didn't know anything about it at all. If you don't know much about it, it's full of dwarves and giants and elves and hobbits and dragons and battles and all sorts of things. And when we came out, I said, it's quite long as well. So after about 3 hours, we came out and I said, what do you think of it? And she said, well, I thought it was a bit far-fetched. And that is a true story. But does that stop it being truthful? Did the story and the way it was told contain truth? Many people would say it's a very truthful story about power, and some see it as a reflection of the threat of nuclear weapons after the Second World War when it came out. About 50 years ago, I heard that, and it might have been possibly said to me that this was people in America, but I won't judge anything by that. But about 50 years ago, I heard that there were some Christians who said, quite rightly, God cannot lie, so Jesus' parables can't be made up. They must be real events that happened to real people that only he knew about, so he could use it to illustrate the points he wanted to make. Now, I don't know about you, but that seems to be stretching things rather a long way to maintain the truth that God cannot lie. Many of us have favourite Bible stories. I'm very fond of the story of Mephibosheth, which is a very little known Bible story. He was the grandson of King Saul of Israel. And when King David took over, instead of doing what everyone expected kings to do, which is to get rid of any members of the existing royal family so they couldn't pose a threat, Mephibosheth was brought into the palace, and in the Bible it says he dined at the king's table just like one of the king's own sons. So it's a great illustration of the grace of God through Jesus that David treated Mephibosheth so well, when he could have, and many thought should, have deserved exactly the opposite. That was quite an obscure story. Many of us have favourite Bible stories. Many, many people today really don't know hardly any Bible stories. If you watch quizzes on TV, you might have noticed that when the Bible questions comes up, it's most likely there will be an I don't know or a wrong answer given, whether it's university challenge or pointless or anything else. I used to run 3 Open the Book teams. Now, Open the Book is a Christian organisation which goes into schools, ideally the same school every week, to tell a Bible story in assembly. And that's basically it. There's a little bit of introduction and a prayer at the end, but it's basically telling a Bible story. And it's extremely popular. And there are thousands of Christians around the country in Open the Book teams that go out and tell the stories. I could talk to you the rest of this morning about Open the Book and how brilliant it is, and let's go and do it, but that'll have to be another time. But what was interesting, at one time we did the story of Saul's conversion, and we tend to act them out. And in one of the schools we acted this out, a big primary school, we were acting it out on the stage, and I was Saul and struck down and collapsed on the ground, and we did the story and said the little bit at the end and the prayer. And usually then a teacher in charge would get up and say, thank you very much, let's give them a clap, children, and off we go. And this time, though, the teacher got up, a lady probably in her late 30s, and she said, well, that was really interesting, wasn't it, everybody? And I went, yes. And she said, that was a fascinating story. I'd never heard that story before. And that really struck home to me. Not that it wasn't her fault, but if we think the Bible's important, Bible stories are important, then what are we doing about it, is perhaps a question we could be thinking about. I once saw a book called The Top 10 Bible Stories. And when I looked at them, this was the list of contents. Do you notice anything? They're all Old Testament. There's nothing about Jesus at all in the top 10 Bible stories. I did wonder, perhaps this was a book prepared for Jewish children or a Jewish school, in which that would be understandable. But when I looked further, I saw it was published by an educational publisher called Scholastic, which has books in practically every primary school, at least, that you would go to in the country. So that made me think of it. And it also made the Scripture Union, that Christian organisation, evangelistic organisation to children and young people. And so they did a survey of both Christians in churches and school teachers to ask, what 10 Bible stories do you think are the priority stories to pass on to the next generation? Now, you have a piece of paper and some pens, or two pieces of paper or more, on your table. So if you would like to, for a few minutes, I'll give you a little bit longer than we had just now, to come up with your 10 Bible stories you would put in that top 10 Bible stories book that should be passed on to the next generation, as it says in Psalm 78. We pass these things on to the next generation so they might know the wonderful deeds of the Lord. Okay, a few minutes to come up with. If you go, don't get to 10, don't worry. But start with the most important, you think, and work your way down. Perhaps you might want to aim to at least get the top 5. And then we'll see how the time goes later on. I found when thinking about this, do I want to pick just stories which are exciting or well-known stories, or things that tell us something about God? That may be part of your decision-making, I don't know. A little bit longer. Okay, if you'd just like to draw that to a close. Don't worry if you're not down to number 10 or whatever, as I say. You might have time to do that later. Okay. I'm not going to ask you to shout out what you've got. We could spend the rest of the morning having a discussion and, oh, I put that before that one. Well, why did you do that? And so on, but we won't do that. What we will do is show you what the results of the survey were. And after the name of the story, we got a percentage, and that was how many percentage of the responders to the survey chose that one somewhere in their list. And obviously the one that was most chosen became the top of their list, which is, as you can see, the crucifixion of Jesus. 94% of the Christians and school teachers, who some of whom I'm sure were also Christians, if not all, put that as their first one. Then stories of Jesus' birth, Adam and Eve, as you can see, the Good Samaritan, the Ten Commandments, then number 6, the lost or prodigal son, number 7, Noah's Ark, 8, David and Goliath, 9, Daniel in the lion's den, and 10, the feeding of the 5,000. And if you look closely, you'll see 5 are Old Testament and 5 are New Testament, which I think is just a fact or coincidence of the results. Those were the top 10 by the percentage of people who chose them. Now, we might want to argue with that a bit or talk about it or say, well, why is David and Goliath there? It's an exciting story, but yes, it teaches you to trust God, but there's this story as well, or whatever. I'm just hoping that number 1, the crucifixion of Jesus, actually means the Easter story and includes the resurrection. Otherwise, we may as well all go home now, to be honest. But an interesting selection there, and perhaps as we might have to wait a bit for the others to come back, depending on how engrossed they are, you can perhaps carry on if you didn't get to number 10. Some of those may have given you ideas that, oh, I forgot that. Yes, we ought to have that, or whatever. But perhaps a bit more listening rather than talking from you time now. Today's story. Jesus was in a tricky situation, being questioned by the chief priests and elders of the people about where his authority for what he was doing and saying came from. And he answered them by offering them a deal. Did you notice that? He did, offered them a bargain, a deal. He said, well, if you'll answer my question, then I'll answer yours. He'd answer their question about where his authority came from, if they answered his question to them about John the Baptist's baptism, and where was that, of God or just of John's invention? And as we heard and saw in the reading, they chose to say they didn't know the answer to that. They probably did have in their minds a very clear answer, but they were afraid if they said there's nothing to do with God, then the crowd who thought John was a prophet would riot. So they chose to say they didn't know. So Jesus then said, well, you're not answering my question, I won't answer yours. But there we then get this parable. I was talking to Jo, my daughter, who's, I was going to say here today, she's here somewhere today, over the phone about what parable I was going to talk about. And she said, I'm not sure I ever heard that one. And that may be true for some people here. It's one of these very short little parables that Jesus told to make a particular point. So we get this parable of the two sons, which seems very, very short and simple and easy to understand, but which in fact was highly disturbing to those priests and elders of the people who Jesus was talking to, because it addresses that simple question we've looked at already: what matters, what you say or what you do? Now, in a very erudite book I looked up, this parable was called Pretend Obedience versus Delayed Obedience. But I prefer the yes and no boys, to be honest, because that just about sums it up. And it's the first of three stories in Matthew here about being obedient to God and what that means, where Jesus is, in all three cases, responding to these self-appointed and self-righteous religious leaders and priests when they questioned his authority and frequently criticised the sort of people he mixed with. Now, I suppose the situation in this story was fairly familiar to anyone who's a parent or anyone who's been a child, which is just about everybody, I would think. Someone promises to do something for us and then doesn't deliver. And then someone else, who perhaps we'd least expect to, comes up trumps after all. Or perhaps it reminds us of times when we have behaved like either of these two sons, agreeing to something but not following up on it, or turning someone down and then having a change of heart. It's fairly straightforward, isn't it? The first son, having better things to do, refuses his father's request to help on the farm, later on realizes the error of his ways and goes and does what he's been asked to do. The second son, immediately he's asked, gives the right answer and very politely agrees to help, and then doesn't. Perhaps something came up, perhaps he forgot, perhaps he put off doing it until it was too late, perhaps he had a better offer, we don't know. But he didn't do what he said he would do. So then Jesus asks the question, which has a very obvious answer: which of the two did what his father wanted? And his hearers, already seeing where this was going, get very defensive and answer very reluctantly and as shortly as they can when they say the first. So they hear what they don't want to hear, that the naughty boy, if you like, is recognized as being in the right, and the good, polite, apparently obedient boy does what is wrong. And then Jesus goes on briefly to wrap it up a bit to them in case any of them still haven't got it. He tells them the sinful people they despise, and tax collectors and prostitutes were amongst them, as mentioned, those sinful people who are humble and sorry and change their ways are entering into God's kingdom, or the kingship of God comes into their lives, before the very people, those he's talking to, who think themselves favoured by God for their religious lifestyle and speech, but who by their actions and attitudes, Jesus implies, are truly not obeying or serving God. So our simple question was, what matters, what you say or what you do? And this parable of the two young boys clearly gives the answer, as we heard on the video, that what you do matters more than what you say. Actions speak louder than words, and all those other cliches and sayings are often used because they're true. But what we say does matter as well. We want to be people whose words are helpful, courteous and trustworthy, as well as being people who do what is right. Someone once said, saying without doing cancels out what's been said. Doing underlines or authenticates the saying. It's interesting that one of the most well-known invitations given by Jesus to all people everywhere isn't to believe this or say that or promise anything else to or about him. It is to do something, to take action. When he says, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest, and you will find rest for your souls," he's using what English teachers call imperative words, doing words, action words. He's not asking us to think things or say certain things, but to do something. To come to him, to turn away towards him, away from our own ways to his way. And when we do that, it will seem to be true in what we do, how we behave, as well as in what we say. And this parable very importantly shows us that however many times or however strongly we've said no to God in the past, we can, like that son, change our minds and turn to him. We can come to Jesus and find rest for our souls. But it's when we realise, like that first boy, that what we've said and thought and done about him so far is wrong, and that we're sorry, then we can take action and do the right thing, as it were. In Bible language, this is called repenting. It literally means turning round and going back the other way, turning ourselves around to go a different way from the way we'd chosen. So it's not only what we say about God that's important, it's more important to do what God asks of us, to turn to him, to accept his ways and plans for our lives. And then we will, as he said, find rest for our souls and new joy in living with him. Other challenges in this passage for us today are to be sure that we are responding to Jesus, allowing him to confront us at any point where we've been like that second son and said yes to God when in fact going off in the other direction. And what we should also be asking ourselves is this: what should we, Jesus' followers today, be doing to challenge the prevalent worldview of the present day with the news that Jesus is indeed its rightful Lord? What should we be doing that would make people ask of us, "By what right are you doing that?" To which the proper answer would be not to tell or ask questions about John the Baptist, but to tell stories about Jesus himself. And I don't just mean Bible stories here, but stories of our lives with Jesus too. People will argue cases and arguments about history and the facts of Jesus' life and death or resurrection. They cannot argue with your story of your experience of Jesus. Stories are brilliant. People love stories. The stories of our lives with Jesus need sharing.